Thank you, Cindy. And again, welcome to all of you for attending this. And I think we all have a great interest in finding out what is public banking and what can the city of Seattle do to maybe promulgate this idea that may be of benefit for those of us who are residents of Seattle. So I think we're in for a very exciting evening. We have a very distinguished, very knowledgeable panel here that I'd like to introduce. But before I do that, because the concept of public banking did not just start out here as far as in the state of Washington, we have someone here that I'd like to maybe say a few words before we start with the panel, and that's Senator Bob Hasegawa of the 11th District, State Senator Bob Hasegawa. Bob kind of got this thing going a few years ago, and so I'd like him to say give us a little background.
Well, thank you, Wayne, and to our distinguished panel. You know, I am just so excited about this because you see this snowball rolling and the people are starting to get it. This has been a project that has been in the works, at least for me personally, since the Maine banking crash in 2008. But even before then, you always have heard about the Bank of North Dakota and have said, why don't we do something like that here? I mean, it just makes all the sense in the world. So you all know, I imagine you're here because you know what public banking is all about, so I won't go through any of that. But I would like to go into some of the straits that the state is in right now. You know, we just passed, we have been unable to pass a transportation budget in the Senate for 2 years now, and you can see the infrastructure literally starting to crumble around us, the inadequacy of it all. Our debt ceiling, limiting our capability to be able to do anything meaningful to try and transform our infrastructure so that we can actually have economic development here. Let alone that, complicated by the fact that the voters just passed Initiative 1351, which cuts class sizes in half, which means we need to double classroom space, or unless you want to double up teachers in a single classroom, but I don't know how much good that's going to do. So we have all of these pressing needs. You know, the legislature has raided the public works assistance account, defunded it, and diverted the revenue streams that feed the public works assistance account, which is what local governments rely on for dependable low-interest loans so that they can build safe water systems and sewer systems and some ancillary road projects and that sort of thing. So we have huge needs, infrastructure needs in our state, but we also have huge economic development needs. We've got small businesses who are having problems with access to credit because big banks don't pay attention to the needs of small businesses. They could care less from Wall Street what's going on here in Washington State. So those kinds of needs all pile up to the fact that there is a better way. We can use taxpayers' dollars for the benefit of the taxpayers of Washington State. That's the whole goal, is smart use of public funds and build our capacity so that, you know, a public bank isn't necessarily a panacea that's going to fix all of our problems overnight, but our children and our grandchildren, if you follow, like Grandpa said, you put a penny in the piggy bank every day for the next 50 years, imagine the resource that our grandchildren can have to build the type of society we all want them to have. That's the goal, not necessarily short-sighted gains, you know, windfalls or whatever. It's building for the future. Our generation, while they're saying now that they will be the first generation that will be less educated than the previous generation in the history of mankind, that is sad. We need to leave them something, a legacy, so that they can build that world that we all want them to have. This is a serious attempt to move that direction. I'm so tickled to have our great guests here and experts, especially Dr. Keidel, who is from Germany, who is going to be speaking about their system. And I was just fascinated to hear. It's different than how I imagined it. So I really appreciated the conversation, but hopefully you'll get something out of his descriptions of what's going on about public banking. So anyway, I've talked too long. That's what you get for asking a politician to speak. So I am going to turn it over to our distinguished panel and say, solidarity, let's move our country forward.
Thank you, Senator Hasegawa. That was very inspiring. So I'd like to start out with Councilmember Licata. He currently is the chair of the City Council's Finance and Culture Committee, as well as the Budget. Councilmember Licata has served on City Council since 1998 and has chaired several other committees, including Parks, Public Safety, Human Services, and Housing. So, Councilmember Licata, I'd like to kind of have you get started and tell us a little bit about what you're seeing or why you are even interested in this idea of public banking for the City of Seattle.
Thank you very much. And I'm not an expert. I just want to give a little background on why I felt this is an important issue and why I've worked with fellow citizens in putting together the forum we have this evening. And also, we had a review before my finance committee this afternoon, which we had the same experts basically discussing before my committee. And we had three other council members there, Councilmember Sally Bagshaw, Councilmember Jean Godden, and Councilmember Shama Sawant were all there and engaged. And we, earlier in the day, met with a fairly large group of people in the affordable housing industry interested in how a public bank might be able to assist them in providing greater housing in Seattle. In fact, it came out at that meeting that when you look at the overall cost of borrowing, it could be as high as 3/4 of the total cost of long-term costs of putting up buildings for housing. So if we could tap into a mechanism that could significantly lower those costs, we could produce more low-income housing. And then tomorrow we'll be meeting with people from the business community, particularly small businesses, to answer their questions, to explain how a public bank may work, and also point out how other communities are very interested in assisting their smaller businesses regarding getting better access to credit. I was able to attend a conference held in Santa Fe several months ago that was actually sponsored by the mayor of Santa Fe, Javier Gonzalez, who is the new mayor there. He ran in a very contested race. There were like six other candidates, and one of his primary platforms was, let's go forward and see what we can do to create a public bank, and that really resonated with the public, and in particular the chamber there, and so he received a lot of support from the business community. I have noted that whenever the term public bank comes up, reporters perk up their ears. People are really interested in this topic. There's something about it, I think, that really captures the imagination of people thinking that, as Senator Hasegawa pointed out, we could actually use public funds most directly to help people in the community, as opposed to taking those public funds and then invest them in stocks or bonds or something that goes into the larger basically financial industry that's far off and in many ways unresponsive to communities and in many ways, in fact, irresponsible, as we've seen in the recent recession. I have been familiar with Senator Hasegawa's efforts. He's been at it. He didn't mention it, but I think for at least 4 years or so in the state legislature. And I've always admired his tenacity and basic political smartness in getting sponsors and adjusting the legislation each year to try to adjust it to answer the criticisms, and it keeps getting better. Unfortunately, there are some people who keep moving the goal down the road. Every time he meets their objectives, they find something else that they could object to in it. But we are not alone in this quest. Vermont, in fact, did a feasibility study for public banking. The city of Santa Fe literally last month approved putting aside money, their city council did and the mayor, to do a public banking fiscal impact study. There are people in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, who are trying to persuade their city government to do something. So there are cities around the country that are recognizing that they're not going to receive help from Wall Street, they're not going to receive help from Chase Manhattan and Bank of America, and that we have our own resources. Here's a way of organizing our own resources to make better use of it and assist those who are either in businesses or individuals trying to protect or trying to save their homes. There are, what I found, and I'll end with this, there's not any one particular model. There's multiple models, and I think that's what I encourage you to, as the speakers do their presentation, think about what they have to say, think of questions that you have. It's my intent that as we move forward, we look at this in a deeper way. My task is, quite honestly, to convince the other council members that this is a worthy objective to investigate and to pursue. And if I can succeed in that, then we can take the next step down the road. And in ending, I also want to once again mention, Senator Hasegawa mentioned, my legislative assistant, Noah Aldrich, who's really been very instrumental in helping put this together and our whole effort. So Noah's back. Noah, why don't you stand up and wave? I don't know. There you are. And he's got some information, and if you need to receive any additional information, he can provide you assistance. So thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you, Councilmember Licata. Our next speaker is going to be Carl Beitel. Mr. Beitel holds a PhD in sociology from the University of California in Davis, formerly employed as a policy analyst for Food First, and has five-plus years experience conducting policy-related and legal research for public sector unions in the Bay Area. Mr. Beitel?
Well, thank you very much. So when we were talking about the panel earlier, I offered and was nominated to try and give a little bit of historical context about the larger context in which the discussion about public banking and municipal banking is taking place. Just a brief word about my own history is that I've lived in San Francisco for quite some time, and I first remember hearing about this idea, I think back in around 2000, and I thought it was a very fascinating idea, and I would talk to people about it, and there always seemed to be, people would raise these, you know, you can't really do it because of this, or you can't really do it because of that, and it never really went anywhere. There was a mayoral race in 2003, and there was a Green Party candidate, Matt Gonzalez, who actually introduced public banking into his platform, and so that's when it resurfaced. And then the history of it in San Francisco is that sort of Nick Licata's counterpart in San Francisco, John Avalos, had some hearings before the board and kind of broached the idea, and then he sent a letter to the city attorney saying, could we do this? And the city attorney sent a letter back saying, no, you can't do it because of constitutional issues. And that's kind of when I was brought in, because they showed me the letter and it was clear that regardless, I didn't know all the legal issues like I know them now, but it was clear that the grounds they were citing that you couldn't do this on, it was a very perfunctory blow-off letter that they had sent. So we led a pushback and got a reconsideration. Very good research they finally did on this, and they determined that in California, charter city powers would allow cities or counties to establish municipal banks. Now, one of the reasons I'm saying this is that you might also have heard this issue of constitutionality, that there may be legal obstacles, and I think that that's really not a solid argument. I think that there is actually the basis within established precedent in Washington State to seriously consider this issue. So I think it's a public policy initiative that can actually be very seriously broached. So the question that, again, I'm going to just try and say a few words about is kind of the larger context, kind of the historical context. Why all of a sudden is public banking on the radar screen? Why do we talk about it now, and what would be potentially its larger implications, to kind of follow up some of what Nick was saying? I think that for me, a way to think about this is if we look at, there's been kind of a long history of development in the U.S. and globally, but the U.S. has kind of been the leader of what is, you may have heard this term, neoliberalism, right? But this idea of the attack on the government, the attack on the public sector, the attack on the legitimacy and validity of public sector interventions, public programs, social welfare systems. And this really goes back to, in some sense, particularly at an urban level, the mid-1970s and the defunding of HUD. And there was a process that was started that began to take a lot of federal money that used to flow to cities to address some of these problems like affordable housing, infrastructure development. There were a lot of problems with those federal programs. I don't think we should necessarily romanticize the world that was prior to Ronald Reagan. But there were certain things about generally, Richard Nixon said in 1972, we're all Keynesians now. So even Richard Nixon was economically to the left of where Democratic presidential candidates generally line up today. So there's definitely been this major shift, and there were a series of, there was the defunding of HUD, there was the election of Reagan, and one of the main ways Reagan built his electoral coalition was an attack on urban social welfare programs. So he phased out CETA, he began to further defund HUD, he transformed the housing allocations that came through the FHA, moved to Section 8. So there was this general shift towards attacking urban programs, attacking federal programs that were giving money to cities. And that was a very important part of the way he built his electoral coalition, and the shift towards the right, towards a more conservative economic climate, and what eventually became known as, quote, neoliberalism. And under Reagan, you also had moves towards financial deregulation. So there was the 1980 and 1982, the deregulation of the savings and loans. There were other things that were a little more, kind of technical and complicated. And there were also things that began to happen under Alan Greenspan that are less well known, but really laid the basis for what eventually led to the repeal of Glass-Steagall. So Greenspan began to essentially loosen a lot of the regulatory requirements that the Fed was supposedly imposing on commercial banks, and began to allow commercial banks in the U.S. to do a lot of things that they hadn't been allowed to do before that. So that there was this financial deregulation at the same time that there's been this major cut in federal aid to the cities. And then this is also taking place in the context of growing globalization and the internationalization of markets. So what this has meant for cities like Seattle, San Francisco, and in a very different way Detroit, is that lacking the former sources of funds that they need, they've become more and more dependent on private capital markets, and more dependent on promoting policies to attract private investors. So the term that's often used is a kind of an urban entrepreneurialism, that you need to kind of promote development by giving developers concessions, public-private partnerships, subsidies, tax breaks to attract capital. That's the name of the game. And if you're a city like Seattle, perhaps, or San Francisco has been one of the best cities in the U.S. in terms of attaching a lot of conditionalities to public-private partnerships, because it's such a hot market that property developers, to get into that market, are willing to do things like give a certain affordable housing allocation and those types of things. Seattle, I think, has a more progressive regime than a lot of cities. At the other end of the spectrum, you have the Midwestern cities or a place like Detroit, right, that has undergone massive deindustrialization. And there's been, the idea that the federal government is going to seriously step in and assist Detroit just hasn't been part of the equation. So the point, kind of the larger point of this is that there's been, and then, of course, this deregulation eventually led to the banks and the financial markets destroying themselves. And it was clear to anyone who was paying attention that it was, in fact, public sector intervention, the central bank, that actually kept, it was the Keynesian mechanisms that still exist that prevented a wholesale, absolutely catastrophic collapse that probably would have been worse than the Great Depression had those mechanisms not been there. So I think it's kind of this combination of things of that we don't have the kind of federal aid, we don't have the kind of federal programs that could support alternatives, right? That's, it used to be 30 years ago, people who were looking for an alternative in the city, often it was organizing around trying to transform federal government policy, get more money in, and there were problems with it, again, but that was the context in which people often became active. Now, for better or worse, we don't have that readily available option, and more cities have become ensnarled in these financial networks that have, in some sense, really constrained the options. So I think that one way to think about public banking in kind of a larger sense is that it's reasserting, to me, one of the things that's inspiring about it. I would say that in a personal way, part of the reason I'm invested in this work is it's pushing back against this whole 30-year wave of privatization and the devaluation of the public sector. It's actually saying, no, we actually deregulated the financial markets. You drove us all off the cliff. You've been bailed out by the public sector, and you're acting with total impunity. You're taking more wealth. You're just doing pretty much the same thing. So it's fighting back against that whole wave of privatization that we've encountered. It's reasserting a positive value for the public sector, but it's also doing so in a way that provides very practical solutions to some of the problems that have been created by this very regime of kind of finance tech-led development. So Seattle, I think you are like San Francisco in the sense that it's a relatively wealthy city relative to other U.S. cities, but you have tremendous problems around affordable housing, for instance. People have been talking, and we met earlier, like Nick said, with affordable housing developers. So how could a municipal bank, for instance, provide major sources of funding for affordable housing development? How could a municipal bank begin? Cities have to borrow money now. They don't have the federal aid that used to be. So cities have to go to the bond market and borrow to finance it. How could a municipal bank begin to take some of that activity back inside the city? So rather than paying out billions of dollars, literally billions of dollars, to outside bondholders who are generally the same people who own the banks, rather than paying that money out, you could bring it back into the city and then begin to fund the things that you want to fund, or extending banking services to the unbanked. And that's been another huge problem with the financial system, is its predatory character, right? The whole subprime lending crisis. So to me, we could talk more about some of the specifics of how a bank would work, but I wanted to emphasize more this larger historical context and why I think this is the, in some sense, the moment where this has come on the public agenda, or it could come on the public agenda in a much more serious way, even though there were a lot of problems. But 10 years ago and prior to the financial crisis, I think it didn't have the same kind of traction. So we can talk more about the specifics. I've been doing a lot of work, both over the last month, looking at specificities of Seattle. I've done a lot of work in California and also New York about how banks could work and what their options are, how you could fund them, those types of things. So I'll stop there.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Keitel. So our next speaker is Thomas Keitel. Dr. Keitel is currently director of the Financial Market Relations Department of the German Savings Bank Association. He has extensive experience in the field of international banking, traveling worldwide to discuss with government officials the advantages and applicability of the German savings bank system to other national, state, and municipal governments. Welcome, Dr. Keitel, and we look forward to finding how German savings banks can apply to United States our cities here.
Thank you very much for the introduction. Senator, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to thank you for inviting me to speak to you today and for giving me the chance to visit Seattle for the first time in my life. The issue of a strongly diversified banking market is one which I feel is well worth addressing and one which I plan to cover today. My appeal would be for local public retail banking. Smaller credit institutions structured in the interest of a solid economic development and, importantly, for which there's a legal framework in place to prevent them from being incorporated into one of the big banks at the first opportunity. The German banking market comprises big banks, saving banks, and cooperatives. These big banks may have famous names and international reputation, but in fact, it is the decentrally organized banking groups of the saving banks, lenders banks, and cooperative banks that provide the majority of business financing in Germany. The Saving Banks Finance Group has a 42% market share in business financing, of which more than 80% are medium to long-term loans. The saving banks have more than 70% market share in loans to crafts and small businesses. This segment is almost exclusively covered by saving banks and cooperative banks in Germany. Saving banks are the prime partner for the state-owned KfW. They hand on state-backed promotional loans, for example for startups, but assume parts of the risk. This, however, only accounts to 10% of the saving bank's total lending to enterprises. Since 2008, from the onset of the financial crisis, saving banks have issued an increasing amount of new loans to enterprises. In 2013, plus $89 billion. These are considerable numbers. However, each individual saving bank is rather small. The smallest has total assets of $168 million, and most of the 416 saving banks have total assets of around $1.3 billion. Each of the saving banks is an independent credit institution, fully liable for its management decisions and deeply rooted into its region of operation. If you stand in a market square in any German city, you will see the classic trinity of the church, the town hall, and the main office of the local saving bank. This is typically for the day-to-day business. There's no hiding from customers in distant skyscrapers. Saving banks fuel local economic cycles. The core of the business is converting local deposits into local loans. This means the size of loans that can be issued is determined by the amount of deposits available, with the result that there's little scope for artificial growth. Not only the loans, but also the profits remain in the region. Saving banks divide their profits between their own reserves and spending for social purposes, amounting to $654 million in 2013. It is in the saving bank's own interest for their local community to develop economically, as this is the only way to stimulate the circulation of deposits and loans, and those generate profits for the saving bank. For this reason, saving banks always look for long-term solutions in the form of long-term customer relationships, conservative risk management, and long-term predictable financing solutions for the customers. Saving banks are themselves structured like local enterprises. The 416 saving banks in Germany employ 244,000 people. 19,000 apprentices and trainees work for the Saving Banks Finance Group. And the saving banks paid on aggregate around $3.5 billion in taxes. Not to Berlin, but to municipal budgets of smaller or medium-sized towns such as Itzehoe and Dinkelsbühl. Obviously, this money could be saved if one were based in the Cayman Islands. The question is where it is better invested. For clarification, I would like to add some things which saving banks are not. Saving banks are not non-profit organizations for non-commercial purposes. Saving banks in Germany are subject to the same regulatory requirements as other credit institutions. They are fully competitive and they live solely from the money that they themselves generate. But unlike other commercial banks, profit maximization at all cost is not their principal incentive. Moreover, their funding mandate, which is laid down in law and still applies today, requests a double bottom line. Saving banks should not only aim for profitability, they should also actively benefit society, which they do in four principal ways: to promote savings, through which the saving banks have a broad base of saving deposits. They provide a supply of credit to all sections of the population, which is known as financial inclusion. They provide a supply of credit to small and medium-sized businesses, which is one of the saving bank's core businesses. And fourth, they participate in regional development by sponsoring local social, educational, culture, and sporting initiatives. To make sure that this business model, including the founding mandate, is not weakened, an appropriate legal form is necessary. I would like to describe the example that we have in Germany for you. From a legal point of view, saving banks are institutions incorporated under public law. This term is often misleading, as it refers to the de facto legal independence of saving banks. Neither the municipality nor the state have shares in a saving bank. As legal independent institutions, all saving banks make their own decisions about products, prices, and services locally, tailored to meet local needs. This local need is also includes capital market-based products and security businesses. Saving bank customers have no need for speculative interbank market products. I would like to stress the importance of an element of the saving bank's legal framework, which I consider to be vital for all national economies with local banks, namely the regional principle. The regional principle, principle states that a saving bank is only permitted to operate within the administrative area in which it was founded. Poaching from wealthy regions is not permitted. In turn, the clear definition of business region enables the individual institutions to achieve economies of scale and increase their competitiveness through cooperation. For example, the 416 saving banks have a mutual IT center through which resources are also pooled in the development of rating methods for the corporate customers. German corporate customers have experienced no credit crunch during the years of the crisis. And also, there were banks which needed to be bailed out. Not one of them was a small local bank. I strongly believe that a diversified, decentralized public banking structure underpins local growth and thus economic prosperity. Saving banks conduct the business they understand for people they know. Many thanks for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Keitel. Our final panel speaker is going to be Gwendolyn Hall-Smith. Ms. Hall-Smith was selected to be the executive director of the Public Banking Institute. And she brings a diverse background to PBI, Public Banking Institute, and has been an outspoken advocate of an activist for public banking and a new economy movement. Even though she currently lives in the northeast corner of the country, Gwendolyn has some roots here. She obtained her PhD in international relations from the University of British Columbia. Prior to that, she earned her BA from University of Colorado in Boulder and her master's in political science from Brown University. She's the author of several books on sustainable communities and economic reform, including her most recent book, Creating Wealth, Growing Local Communities with Local Currencies. Gwen?
Thank you. All right, I'm not only batting cleanup, but I'm also doing Intro to Public Banking 101. I'm assuming that you're all here because you know something about public banking, but It's an interesting field of study, as I'm sure you're discovering, because even the two words put together elicit all sorts of responses. I was once called a communist and a socialist before breakfast one morning at a Rotary Club meeting for just using those two words in the same sentence. And of course, you know, the left loves the word public, the right loves the word bank, and also hates the obverse. So it's an interesting mix of people that are brought to this movement from various political backgrounds. And one of the things we're working on the Public Banking Institute is pulling them all together. Everybody from the Tea Party to Occupy to talk about this in the lead up for the next elections, because we think it's a really important issue whose time has come. So what is public banking? Now, the first slide here I made for Vermont, obviously, where we've done a lot of work on public banking, and this shows the way the banking system works for municipalities now. They basically take their tax receipts, the money you all pay in taxes and parking fines and the intergovernmental transfers from the federal government, and they put it in a bank. And then when municipalities need money for their own lending, because municipalities all over the country do lending, when I was in Vermont, I ran the Community Development Lending Institution in Montpelier and made loans to businesses and homeowners, they have to borrow it back from Wall Street. So we send our money to Wall Street to put on deposit, and then we borrow it back at interest when we need it. That's how the system works right now. Public banking tries to short-circuit that process by using the money we would otherwise have on deposit for our own needs and to promote our economy in the local community. Now, what is the difference between a public bank and a private bank? Again, this is Public Banking 101. Well, private banks' missions are a return on investment for their shareholders. That they're a business. They're in it to make a profit. There's nothing wrong with that, but that's what they were set up to do. They also want to maximize profit, minimize risk, and make loans and investments that actually are repaid. They manage for all sorts of risks. If you talk to a typical banker, they won't really recognize that they create money out of nothing, even though the banking system as a whole does that, because individual bankers are so busy managing the risks of banking, which include liquidity risks and interest rate risks and default risks and all these things that make our heads spin, frankly, that they don't really see what they're doing when they're creating credit is putting new money in the system. But that's exactly what they're doing, and that credit creation function is what we're talking about when we're talking about creating a municipal public bank for the city of Seattle. Now, public bank's mission is actually quite different. They're out to do economic development, to build housing, to provide jobs. If you want to get into student loans, like the Bank of North Dakota does, and make loans more accessible and more forgiving for the student population, that's another thing you can do. They also build public infrastructure, public transit, roads, bridges, hospitals, schools. That's public banks' mission. Now, the deposits that private banks get come from all of us, individuals, businesses, governments. Deposits are insured by the FDIC up to $250,000. Over $250,000, and this is an important point, because you can believe that the city of Seattle's deposits are greater than $250,000. In Vermont, little old Vermont, our average daily balance for the state is $350 million. Now, that's orders of magnitude bigger than what the FDIC insures, and this is an important factor for public banks. Banks have to put up collateral to insure those deposits. They have to put up capital. And that means that your local community state chartered banks typically are nowhere big enough to take your public deposits. And so all across the country, public deposits by and large go to the banks that are too big to fail, because they're big enough to capitalize those deposits. And that means that your public deposits, your taxpayer deposits, are going to Wells Fargo here in Seattle or to Bank of America. In our case, in the state of Vermont, it goes to TD Bank North. Now, TD stands for Toronto Dominion. It's a Canadian bank, largely invested in the Keystone XL pipeline, which is something that most Vermonters don't appreciate. So we're in the business of trying to divest from fossil fuels, and that public banking movement in Vermont is certainly part of that. So public bank deposits, the kind of public banks we're talking about here in the city of Seattle and that the Public Banking Institute talks about by and large, accept deposits from the governments, not from individuals and businesses so much as they do in Germany. That could be a long-term vision for banks. But I think if you're really interested in getting a public bank set up here in Seattle, you shouldn't be competing with your local community banks and credit unions, which you will be doing if you start accepting those deposits. You need them as your allies in the initial phase of getting a public bank up and growing. Over time, maybe they could accept these type of deposits, but that's a whole nother realm of work. Public banks in this country, in North Dakota in particular, are more like wholesale banks than they are retail banks. And that's an important distinction as well. They also are going to be required to comply with all the regulatory requirements to insure those deposits with capital and to make sure that they stay safe and sound. After all, these are your tax dollars. You want to make sure that they're managed properly. So private banks lend to individuals, businesses, governments, the usual range of lending, and they earn interest on those loans to pay the interest on their deposits. That's the basic banking model. Public banks also make loans, but they do it in the way we're talking about, in a more wholesale way. So in North Dakota, the Bank of North Dakota partners with the local banks, and the local banks do the retail end. The state bank provides extra funding, extra capital, makes it possible for the local banks to make longer term loans, lower interest loans, loans to sectors that maybe are underserved by the banking community. Like in North Dakota, if you've got a startup business, you can pretty easily get a loan of $25,000 to get that business off the ground. That's actually hard to do in the market, in the banking market. And of course, they earn interest on the lending to pay the interest on the deposits that you make as a public entity in the bank and to provide a revenue stream for the public entity. So this is another way to raise revenue for the other priorities that you have in the city besides taxing or cutting programs, which are the two choices we're given these days by our leaders a lot of the time. So the public banking system is basically a loop. It starts with you, the taxpayers. You pay out in your taxes and your parking fines. That goes into the public bank. The public bank deposits those things on deposit. This isn't like another allocation or a program, and then uses that money for lending that produces a return that comes back to the taxpayer. It's a closed loop, really, and it short circuits all of the money that you're bleeding out of your local economy into the larger banks and other places. Now, this question of all the money that you're bleeding out of your economy into the larger banks and other places is an important question because all of the financial fees and interest that we pay on bonds and other things is like a hidden tax on everything we do. Councillor Licata mentioned this, that this is some research that my colleague Margaret Kennedy from Germany did, looking at how much of everything we do is accounted for by this interest tax. Public housing, you can see down here, the cost of interest on capital can be as much as 77% of the cost of public housing. So we're paying that in interest to the banks to build low-income housing. If we didn't pay that interest out of the system and made more low-income housing, we might not have the tent cities that we're seeing with homelessness around our communities now since the crash in 2008. Drinking water, the cost of interest on capital, 38%. Garbage collection, it's not such a capital-intensive enterprise, apparently. It's only about 10%, at least in her research. And this also spreads to other consumer goods that we buy. About 40% of everything you buy is a tax to the financial sector now, with the kind of burgeoning interest and debt payments that are made in our monetary system. Now, a study was done a few years ago here in Washington State to see what the economic impact would be of a state bank here. And by reallocating these interest payments internally here in Washington State, you could increase the small business loans about 8.2% and create over 8,000 jobs for the state. So it has a genuine benefit in economic impact to do this as well. In Vermont, we did a study last year of the economic impact and feasibility of a state bank in Vermont, and we found that over 2,500 jobs would be created and over $340 million would be added to the gross state product. Now, if we could count on legislatures to actually use data to make decisions, this would be a no-brainer, wouldn't it? Over 2,500 jobs, that's over 15% of Vermont's unemployment rate. That's a significant impact. We're a little state, and we do have unemployment. I'm sure you do too. It's a good thing to create jobs. But unfortunately, the banking lobby in Vermont is a very powerful thing. And they've managed to stop this in its tracks now on a number of occasions. We tried to get the legislature to pay for the study, and the banking lobby stopped that. And so then last year, when we filed legislation on the basis of this study to just take 10% of the treasurer's average daily balance, put it in the Vermont Economic Development Authority, which is already making the loans that we're talking about a state bank making, and using that money to start a public bank on the basis of the Vermont Economic Development Authority and the other lending agencies that we have in Vermont, well, the banks stopped that too, for the most part. Except one thing I realized was that the banking lobby couldn't make it out to every city and town in Vermont. And we have a very important ritual every spring known as town meeting, where all the citizens from all the towns get together and decide on their town budgets. And that's also a really popular time to vote on other things. You might remember back in the 80s how the New England town meetings voted for a unilateral nuclear disarmament, for example. And so I thought, well, let's get the town meetings to vote on public banking. And I started a town meeting campaign. We got 19 towns to vote to direct the legislature to set up a public bank, which is a lot of towns actually taking a stand like that. The banking lobby didn't manage to show up there and convince them otherwise. And so they didn't give VITA a banking license, but they did pass a bill that made the state treasurer transfer 10% of her average daily deposits into VITA for local lending. So right now in Vermont, we actually are starting the process of taking our state funds and using it in Vermont for Vermonters, which is good news for public banking because we are making some progress there. Thank you. Now, public banks might be new in the United States, but as you've heard from Germany, they're not new in the world. Over 40% of the world runs on public banks. Radical fringe countries like Germany and Costa Rica and Taiwan and Brazil and India, you know, this is not a new thing. And it's actually a fairly common form of public finance. So it's not so difficult to do. It's not an untested method. It's just something that somehow the banking system has managed to stop from doing here, except in North Dakota. Now, in North Dakota, back in 1919, a long time ago, the Nonpartisan League, like our new nonpartisan initiative, got together and got a state bank established. The same year they did that, they actually also established a state grain elevator. So North Dakota, one of the redder states, bluer states, I can't never remember, is actually the home of the only state owned grain elevator and the state-owned bank, and they've had an enormous success with the bank, but it didn't start right off that way. Right off, the banks took them all the way to the Supreme Court and tried to overturn the legislation that set it up, and they lost. But people say, well, North Dakota is such a successful bank because of all the oil and gas revenues there, and that's not actually true. You can see from this chart, I know you can't read it, but the blue at the bottom is the part of the North Dakota portfolio that represents the agricultural lending they do. The green is the residential lending. The yellow, which is actually the biggest part, is the student lending. And then the red is the commercial lending. So the revenues that the North Dakota Bank are transferring back into the general fund of North Dakota, which, by the way, have been over $300 million in the last 10 years, North Dakota has actually taken a vote. They were debating whether to get rid of the property tax because of the revenues, the dividends from their public bank. Wouldn't that be a nice debate to have? isn't from oil and gas. In fact, even in the commercial portfolio, not a lot of their lending comes from that sector. There was a pipe company in there that we found and a few other things, but it's not as if this is because solely of the oil and gas industry in North Dakota. And the other thing about North Dakota that's interesting is that their local banks are very healthy. Not a single one failed after 2008. Not a single one. And they haven't been bought up by the big banks either. They still have local community banks that still serve their local community with local community leaders on them. Here's a chart that shows North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming. Notice that there are other oil and gas states represented there. North Dakota still has about 16 banks per 100,000 population, whereas nationwide, the very last one over there, is about 4. You know, and that's because they've been consolidated into these ever increasingly large banks. The other thing to note, of course, about the oil and gas industry related to North Dakota is that there are many states that have that industry, but not the states themselves aren't running in the black, whereas North Dakota is as a state. And that's another important lesson for Seattle, right? Because if you're worried about revenues and you get into public banking, eventually, not immediately, just like your leaders have said, this doesn't happen overnight. It happens over a relatively long period of time. The banking activities that you have in the city will help fund the city's services as a revenue stream, just like the banks make a profit on their lending. The revenue stream as well allows the public bank to do what we call counter-cyclical lending. Banking typically is very pro-cyclical, so the economy crashes because they've made a few too many subprime loans, and they pull back credit to all of the businesses in the area. But you can see here the blue up on the top here is the North Dakota Bank, and after 2008, which is sort of on the right-hand side of the chart, you see their lending went up. So they do counter-cyclical lending and increase lending into their commercial sector during economic downturns to try and help keep their economy going. That's more possible if you have a public bank. Now, just one last moment about what's going on in the banking world in general and why it's so important to start to recapture some of our monetary functions in general. We've gone from the gold standard to the debt standard. And the debt standard drives the growth imperative. It drives environmental destruction. It drives wealth concentration and human impoverishment. That's just a fact of how the system works. The 1% that people were objecting to so strongly and articulately a few years ago is a function of this system. It's not a function of human greed. I would argue that human greed is a side effect of a system that we've constructed completely wrong. Most of the human beings I know are not inherently greedy, but the system has been built incorrectly. People who are working in the system don't even really understand how it works. They just work in it. It's their job. So demonizing people, making people look like they are bad actors, when really we are all human beings just trying to make a living in a system that's badly tilted toward concentration of wealth and ever-increasing debt and money chasing more debt. These are real figures of both the U.S. money supply and the national debt from the 1800s to the present. They mirror each other. And so that's another reason to bring about public banking, because the interest payment on all that debt is what consolidates wealth in fewer and fewer hands and consolidates power in fewer and fewer hands. So we can start to short-circuit that process as well by taking matters back in our own hands and instituting public banks on every level we possibly can. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hall-Smith. And I'd like to conclude the formal part of our presentation segment by bringing it back to Councilmember Licata, maybe talk about maybe some of the next steps or how we as citizens here can get involved in this process, you know, after this evening. So,
thank you, Wayne. The next steps are going to be small steps, but there will also be very, very clear steps. My intent is, through these forums and the one we'll have tomorrow in the workshop, is to educate the city council and also those members of the executive, the mayor's office, that this is a worthwhile pursuit of looking at how we could go about establishing a public bank. There are hurdles. The biggest hurdle actually is not necessarily, one would think, the big banks that don't want us to exist. It's the legal system that many of the people who are bond counsels to the city, who believe that and who have experience with as attorneys in court cases, believe that the state constitution does not allow the city to establish a public bank, and also the limitations in the state legislature in the Washington State Code. So it's a sort of interesting battle. On one hand, I think that the council members are sympathetic to everything that's been outlined here as far as what the objectives are. I think that the hurdle is a sense that we can still pursue this and deal with each one of those structural problems as they come about. You know, I recently was reading a book by Edmund Morris on Theodore Roosevelt, and it was very interesting to see how and he was faced with some major challenges in trying to curtail the conglomerates during when he was president. He was told, well, the laws just didn't allow for him and the federal government to curtail the powers of the monopolies. And he said, we'll still pursue it because it's the right thing to do. It's the thing to do to help the public. And I think it's the power of persuasion to give the politicians the courage to be innovative, the courage to move forward, and to tackle each of these challenges that we face systematically. There has been research done, and Carl's done some of it, and Senator Hasegawa has done some as well, that show that each of these challenges can be overcome. But it will take hard work, and it will take, I think, a recognition by the elected officials that the public sees this as a valuable course to undertake. So my advice to you is that if you believe that this is a worthwhile course, and again, keeping open that there's different models even amongst the presentations today, I would encourage you, we all these days have access to email, let the council members know, and the mayor's office, that you believe that the city should begin the pursuit of investigating a public bank. That message will allow me to then convince them to put money aside, as was done in Santa Fe and as was done in Vermont, to begin to take the next step, which is studying the possibility. And once we begin that, then we're, I think, down a road that can actually produce results, because then we'll be able to establish a formal dialogue. These things may take some time. I don't think we're going to accomplish it overnight, but if we don't begin going down that path, then we'll never take that journey. So it's my feeling that there's enough momentum now in the city to at least begin a serious discussion. Certainly I'll do my part, but it really helps if other members of the council begin to see this as something other than a nickel cotto sort of idea that is being tossed out there. So that's my suggestion of what the next step should be. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for the panel for their excellent presentations.